This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Elizabeth Pop Berman from SUNY Albany. Elizabeth authored the much-admired Creating the Market University in 2012 with Princeton University Press, and now she's working on a new book, Thinking Like an Economist, How Economics Became the Language of U.S. Public Policy, also with Princeton. We're very happy to have her join us. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
So tell us about your new project, Thinking Like an Economist. What's it about?
Well, it kind of grew out of my first book, right, which looked at it looked at the shift that universities had in terms of becoming more entrepreneurial over a period of several decades. And the punchline of that story, which was not really where I expected to end up when I started, was that a lot of it was first driven by government policy, and second, really driven unintentionally by this shift to thinking about technology and technological innovation as being something that could drive economic growth. And so you get a whole bunch of policies in the late 70s and the early 80s that directly and indirectly kind of encourage more entrepreneurial kinds of activities in academic science that really are motivated by a new set of economic ideas. And so that kind of got me interested in, you know, well, what is the role of economic ideas in policy? And then, I think as a sociologist, we all have kind of a little bit of a chip on our shoulder about economists and how economists get all the attention. And so so I sort of interested in it from a personal level too. And then there's also the piece of it that it felt like that across lots of different types of policy areas, there'd been this shift towards economic language and economic justifications becoming the reason that we justify particular kinds of government policies. So whether it's in terms of saying, you know, we need to do this particular thing because it's going to cause economic growth, or we need to, you know, invest in education because it's an investment in human capital. But this was just an increasingly common language for talking about what policy is trying to do. And so the book is basically, it's a historical story. A lot of it focuses on the period from about 1960 to 1990. And it shows both how economics, and particularly microeconomics — I pay very little focus on macroeconomics in the book. But how microeconomics and microeconomic arguments kind of, enter policy, how economists established, new kinds of locations for their ideas. So both organizationally in different government agencies and so on, and also by expanding into areas like law schools, public policy schools. And then once this sort of advance of economic reasoning had been stabilized to a certain part, I look at how that plays out in particular policy domains. And so I look at changes in antitrust policy, in environmental policy, and in higher education. And so, the argument I'm trying to make is that you can really see claims that come from economic expertise and sort of economic ways of thinking about policy problems shape the range of options that people are willing to talk about and kind of constrain where, you know, I don't think they determine policies. I'm not, you know, I don't want to overemphasize that. I don't want to make the argument that economists determine anything by any means. I think their influence is often kind of marginal, but I think by kind of shaping the terms of debate, there's a real visible effect on the kinds of conversations that we are able to have.
Could you maybe flesh out how do economists think differently from regular people and maybe different from us?
Or an even simpler question, has their role been welfare enhancing?
I don't think that's actually a simpler question, but I think for me, there's sort of two ways of thinking about how economists think. One is sort of this basic package of very simple economic concepts that I don't think have much to do with actually being trained as an economist, but just thinking in terms of incentives, thinking about terms of cost benefit analysis, thinking in terms of trying to create institutions that are going to encourage people to do the things that you want to do, thinking about efficiency as a valuable and worthwhile policy goal. And so I think there's a piece of it that is, it's really almost the Econ 101 version of economics. It's not the especially sophisticated version, but it's the version that you might pick up if you get, say, a master's in public policy, right? And you take a few courses that are economics or that kind of have an economic background, and you use this broad set of tools for learning to think about policy problems. I mean, so that's one way of thinking about it. I think the other way is thinking about it as there isn't one way of thinking of, like an economist, and what that means evolves over time with the discipline of economics itself, right? And so the issues that are on the agenda in economics as a discipline are going to vary across some fields. They're going to change over time. Frameworks are going to change. You know, you have periods where theory is more important and where empirical research is more important. And so I think there's also this piece of it that's about creating these lasting links between economics as a discipline and the policy domain that allow ideas to move back and forth very easily and relatively influentially as economics itself evolves as a discipline.
I actually have two points, right? So that, you know, hopefully you'll comment on. So one has to do, so we, our students, our majors have to write a senior thesis. And, you know, one of my students is writing his senior thesis on the sort of the relative status of behavioral economists versus cognitive psychologists, right? And so basically he's doing this kind of experiment where he's basically going to have people, you know, read work that's basically exactly the same, right? and only change the title of the person who's written it from cognitive psychologist to behavioral economist to see whether or not people rate the work as being actually a lot better and better informed when you have one title versus the other, right?
That's very interesting.
And then because he actually thinks that if you just slap economist behind something, then it always actually is seen as like smarter and better informed than anything else, right?
So my guess is that a lot of that will depend on who he's actually using for his sample.
He's using undergraduates and faculty.
Okay. So people who are going to be kind of in an academic environment already and who are sort of,
yes,
maybe have some broad sense of like this sort of status hierarchy. Because if you look at public surveys, people don't particularly have more or less trust in economists than, you know, many other different professional groups. Like there's no sort of public
When were those public surveys collected? Because I'm thinking like you have this huge public profile. I feel like the public profile for economists, especially applied microeconomists, has been increasing over the last 10, 15 years with like, you know, you have a radio show and blog called Freakonomics. A lot of it is just general social science.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a good question because I feel like I've seen stuff that's been maybe not that old, but it could be 5 years old or so. So it's possible that there's been more change relatively recently.
How much do you think economists really influence the process? I mean, I recall in a Canadian context, I worked for a little bit in a political party, and we generally sought out the economists who supported the policies that we wanted to implement anyways, rather than turning to economists to figure out what to implement.
Yeah, no, I actually totally agree with that and think that the way that the influence matters isn't about sort of being able to push specific policies in one direction or another. It's sort of a more of a long-term shift in changing the terms of debate and changing the kinds of conversations that people have. So I think if you look cross nationally, I think there are definitely specific contexts where economists might have a lot of influence. There's a new book that just came out about economists and tax policy by Johan Christensen that compares the influence across several small countries. And basically, you know, what he argues is that in countries where you've got kind of a strong, independent, expert-driven tax system, you do have real sort of influence that you can argue is causal influence. But when you're talking about people just sort of providing advice to policymakers, it's basically like what you're saying, Joe, that, you know, policymakers seek out the people who line up with what they already want to hear. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do have cases, I mean, I think you can make the case that in antitrust, you do have this kind of real causal effect on what the nature of policy looks like over the long run. And some of that comes through having a policy area that's driven heavily by the executive branch and by the courts and isn't particularly driven by Congress and legislation. But I think, you know, what happens in those kinds of cases is that, you know, you sort of find ways to convince people, convince other experts, convince lawyers in this case, partly by, you know, expanding over time, expanding a role in law schools, that thinking about antitrust, for example, in terms of consumer welfare and in terms of consumer welfare being the core goal and what you're trying to achieve by having antitrust policy ends up, you know, eventually you can see that institutionalized, right? And so it's institutionalized through court decisions. It's institutionalized through practices in the antitrust division and the FTC so that this becomes kind of the only way that people are willing to do it. And at that point, you have real causal influence. But it's not because somebody recommended a specific policy. It's more this sort of long-term process of shifting the conversation and then through one of various means, institutionalizing those changes so that other people
because recall I said I had two comments. The second comment is on my commute to work. I very, very often will meet up with a commuting buddy who works for the Fed. He's an economist, and he very, very often talks about, you know, like economics being on the decline, about, you know, the input of economists being not as important in shaping policy anymore. And I can tell that he feels that he actually believes that's so, right? So is he right?
I mean, I think there's two ways to think about that, maybe. And I, you know, say kind of jokingly, maybe that's because he's a macroeconomist, but I do think there is this relative shift, right, in the status, both within the profession and externally in macro and microeconomics. And so, you know, I do think there is sort of a more pervasive sense of unease in macroeconomics about where things are going and you know, what influence is going to be in the future. And I don't see that happening in the micro fields to the same degree. I mean, the other thing you could say is, well, a lot of this is a question of like what's happened in the last year, and we've sort of tossed expertise out the window entirely. And so, right. So, you know, I guess it depends on when he's been saying this. And if it's, you know, since November 2016, I think it's a whole different story than if you're talking about, you know, the years.
No, I think he's been saying like for the past 10 years, he's felt like there's been a bit of a decline.
Since the late. I have a question. So when you say shifting the terms of the debate, in my mind, I imagine the mechanism to be like a proliferation of concepts or some type of framing of the cost benefit of making choices. So what specifically are, into your mind, some great examples of the specific ways that economics has reframed our debate to be something that it wouldn't be otherwise?
Yeah, well, I think environmental policy actually provides really good, clear examples of this, because, you know, so the big pieces of environmental legislation, you know, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, I mean, these are passed in the early 1970s, and they are passed kind of coming out of this period of social movements and of people, you know, having millions of people show up on Earth Day and these kinds of things. And they're all very much framed around establishing new kinds of rights, having rights to clean air, rights to clean water. Everything is set up in terms of these absolutes, right, that we're going to, eliminate health effects resulting from having water pollution and so on. And so you have in this period this whole new regulatory framework that's set up that is very much about that's kind of dominated by people who've got this enforcement mindset, who have this this idea, you know, that's sometimes written into law, that what we want is to have no pollution at all. And you know, it's really economists who come in and say, well, this is just not feasible and it's irrational, and you know, it doesn't make sense for us to say that we have a right to a clean environment in some absolute sense. There's always costs and benefits and trade-offs to making these kinds of decisions. And so, you know, so over the course of the 1970s and into the Reagan administration, you have this gradual advance of cost benefit analysis where, you know, you all of a sudden you're going to say, okay, well, we can think about what are the costs of allowing a certain amount of pollution in our water and what are the benefits and, you know, how many people are actually going to get sick or actually going to die from this. And, you know, what's the value of the wildlife that's going to be killed if we allow our lakes to have a certain amount of pollution in them. And, you know, initially there is a lot of resistance and a lot of pushback to this, and people just are fundamentally opposed to the idea of thinking about something like putting a value, a monetary value on human life. But what happens is that over time, you have a gradual acceptance of the idea of thinking about this in terms of costs and benefits, and that quantifying these kinds of decisions is, you know, not only appropriate, but is sort of the only rational way to think about them. And, you know, it's mostly happening through the regulatory system, but by the time that you are in the early 80s, you have a very different way of thinking about how you should make decisions about environmental policy. And, you know, I think there's cost to that and there's benefits to that, right? That on the one hand, the idea that you're going to have no pollution anywhere at all is probably just ridiculous. I mean, it's certainly correct that you can only spend, you know, that getting that last like 1% of pollution out of the water is going to be expensive and perhaps not worth it. But at the same time, you know, making these decisions, cost-benefit decisions, makes them these very technical decisions. It kind of takes politics out of it in a certain way. At the same time, it hides other kinds of politics because these political debates are fought out through, you know, competing ideas about what the value of a statistical life is instead of being fought over the you know, political fights that are actually hiding underneath that. And so, you know, so I think it's got trade-offs in terms of whether what parts of it are an improvement and what parts aren't. But I think that that's a good example of how you really have a change in how people think about a policy domain.
So I was thinking about that, you know, listening to the story about the change in environmental policy from command and control to more of an emphasis on, you know, pricing for different elements, property rights for different elements, all that sort of thing. And it reminded me of Alan Fiske's work on relational models, where he distinguishes between, you know, various ways that we can think about economic relations, but the two that are relevant are authority ranking, which is kind of like we have a hierarchical relationship. The superior has duties and obligations. The inferior has duties and obligations, and the inferior's duty is to obey. You know, so the state basically says this is what to do. In contrast to a market pricing relationship, which is we treat this as a market, maybe it's barter, maybe it's cash, but we have an explicit commensuration where any two objects can be commensurated on a common scale for each other. And so we have things like a, you know, statistical value of a quality adjusted life year, or, you know, a statistical value for a bald eagle, you know, the excess mortality of bald eagles or something like that, rather than just saying you can't ever do anything that would, you know, kill a bald eagle. And that's a command and control thing. And there is a logic to it, right? Where sometimes it can be more efficient. But like you said, people very often balk at it because they have a way of thinking about something in terms of it's simply wrong, regardless of whether it's efficient or not. Almost saying, well, whether or not it's wrong makes it, it's still efficient. That almost seems more offensive until you get used to thinking of that way, in which case you just normalize it, and then it becomes that's the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting and that's sort of really like the long-term changes here is how that normalization has spread, right? And I'm not putting a moral value on whether the spread of the moralization itself is a good thing or a bad thing. But if you go back, like a lot of my story sort of starts at the Rand Corporation and stuff that was going on in the 1950s. And in the 50s, you know, so you've got a situation where, you know, you've got people who are sort of the most kind of, you know, top of their field, kind of hard-headed and quantitative types, and they they're not able to put a value of life on losing a airman who's flying a plane, because that's simply beyond the pale. Nobody's willing to talk about it. And, you know, it takes a while even for economists to become comfortable with making these kinds of value judgments, or sort of putting these numbers on things that in another context we would think of as beyond valuing in that kind of way. But then, you know, eventually economists come to take it for granted. And then eventually, I think, if maybe not the entire population, it's certainly within kind of broad policy conversations, it becomes sort of a totally normal way of thinking about the problem.
So the military context reminds me of an interesting, so a book that I enjoyed a while ago that Miguel Centeno had me read was, what's it called? A Perfect War by Gibson, who I think is a sociologist at Cal State Long Beach. And it's about the hyper-rationalization of war in Vietnam, although really it's about Westmoreland's era of the war. So if you don't know the history of Vietnam or the Vietnam War, basically the early war was run by Westmoreland, and then the later war was run by Creighton Abrams. And the Westmoreland phase of the war was rationalized, and it had like point values attached to different things. And there was a certain, and like some of the commanders, this wasn't necessarily Westmoreland's policy per se, but there were certain commanders for a different district who would have like point values assigned to, if you capture a tactical radio, that's 100 points. If you kill an officer, that's 200 points, et cetera, et cetera. Or, you know, if you accidentally kill a civilian, that's negative 75 points. And that was how they measured success in the war, was by counting these points together. That all went away when Abrams took over. And Abrams had more of an emphasis, less on how many enemy, you know, putting point values on a war of attrition. And instead, Abrams had this idea of, we're going to clear territory of the enemy, train our local allies, and then have our local allies hold the territory. And there was no point values assigned to any of that. But, you know, the Westmoreland phase of the war didn't work, right? And so it's you could take that as an example of how rationalized thinking can go awry. And, you know, if you're quantifying things and commensurating things, that can be good. And it seems to have been fairly effective in U.S. environmental policy. But it also seems to have been pretty effective in the first phase of the Vietnam War, really, is, well, you know, the pre-Tet phase of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and maybe this is one of the real risks that goes along with this kind of quantification, is that I think it's easy to have a lot of faith with it, right? You know, the piece of the Vietnam story that I know best is sort of the McNamara part, because, you know, he brought all these RAND guys over who then ended up going.
Yeah, McNamara and Westmoreland is the same phase. Basically, Johnson, yeah. McNamara, and Westmoreland all went together. And then after that, it was Abrams and Nixon.
Yeah, basically, I mean, so there's a big part of my story that's basically about all the guys McNamara brought from RAND who then, after they're done spending their time at the Defense Department, go over and work for the Budget Bureau, where they launch basically similar kinds of methods, you know, basically more or less cost-benefit methods for thinking about policy into things like the war on poverty, into all these different social agencies, and that's really a big piece of the story of how this all spreads. But you know, I think it's very clear that that there was a lot of confidence in quantification that wasn't really justified in that period. And I think that 5 years later, when those people had all made all their efforts to try to rationalize social policy, you know, they ended up very much in the same place, that everybody thought it was going to be the greatest thing and solve all the problems and would be able to make great government decisions. And instead you end up, you know, just realizing that quantification and cost benefit analysis and all these methods are tools, and they can be useful tools, but they've got a lot of limitations as well. And so, you know, so I think there's a piece of it that kind of comes in and out at different moments of the story that's really about the, you know, the arrogance of being too confident in one's methods, which I don't think is necessarily something that's only associated with economists, but could be any kind of you know, social science or any kind of knowledge production, really, right? That that our ability to take the things that we know about how the world works and apply them to some kind of action in the world is just always going to be limited. And so we should always be pretty modest about how we can do that.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.